can think of while steadying my breath so as not to make another sound is that nobody's going to be okay for a while. Teddy is pushing the bright side, too. You can get back to school and... He trips on whatever was next, and for a long moment, he can't even speak. Let's just be together, he says. In another minute, his eyes droop. In another, he's out. He went down fast. Geraldine tenses with the urge to do something. She stuffs another pillow behind his head, accentuating his shallow breathing. Is he dead? Haley asks me. Not yet. Then can he hear us? Asks Ruby. Some part of him can, I say. Hannah shouts, We love you, Daddy! Into his face. What is she even making of this whole event? Nettie dabs her eyes with her knuckle. Haley asks, How long does it take for him to totally be... A few more minutes. With this information, their trauma turns to curiosity as they study each inhalation, waiting for death to take over his body. A sudden deep breath comes, as if he's been startled, followed by a wet gurgle. Haley looks to me for guidance. Nettie notices. Big win. I don't think he's conscious now, I assure Haley. It's more of a reflex. The noise increases, gets closer to a drowning gag. I tell them how to let his head rest back to modify the acoustics in his throat. Not for him so much, but for them. This moist sound is the last audio they'll have of him. Last week, Nettie performed an assist, which went off without any interruptions. I watched it again last night as an instructional. A youngish woman, advanced motor neuron disease, still able to lift the cup. No witnesses present to shower her in I love yous, just a quiet thank you to Nettie as she shut her eyes and waited. Nettie rubbed the woman's hand for 5 minutes more, emanating well-trained warmth, until the neck relaxed and the face fell slack. A few minutes of weak raspiness, then silence. At that instant, I caught a rare glimpse of uncertainty in my supervisor. Alone with the body, her eyes searched around the room in controlled panic, as if the woman might have played a trick, hid in the closet or under the bed. The moment passed, but the uncanniness of death was briefly evident. A final bubble bubbles up from Teddy's throat, and he comes to a halt. Anywhere else in the hospital, this is an emergency. Here, it means a good outcome. Geraldine is a single parent. I lead the family through this moment by telegraphing wise and respectful thoughts to the best of my ability. Geraldine, unforgiving of the gods that brought her to this, shepherds her daughters into her arms. Her expression falters, as if the real flood is about to begin. Then the smell reaches us. A fart, or worse, from Dad. Hannah isn't too upset to acknowledge it by pinching her nose. This distinct mood breaker is my cue. I reach past the tangle of embraces to pull a blanket from the foot of the bed up to Teddy's chest to limit the smell's range. Breathing through my mouth, I check pulses, radial and carotid. The family seems willing to step away from him for this, as I keep my fingers on his dull, warm blood, waiting for the requisite minute. Geraldine watches me as I count out exactly nil pulses of blood moving beneath his skin. Dad is dead now, she tells the kids. I confirm with a doctorly nod. Do you want time alone with him? No, I don't, she says, with the most certainty she's shown all morning. He's not here. Away from the main stage, I notice Nettie drop a paper towel onto the puddle of Nimbutol and deftly foot-mop it under the bed. She then leads the daughters, who have opted to skip this part, down the hall to the bereavement room, consulting room C. Geraldine and I stay behind to wash the body. I fill the basins, bring in the towels from the bathroom, and pull down the sheets. Gaunt and sallow flesh. Still, more lifelike than it will be in an hour.